Nice to see you. I see some faces. I know that's very nice. So welcome to my talk. And this year I've sort of gone into a bit of a trendy thing because everyone has unicorns. So, and first about me, I'm El Nerdinger. I'm a political advisor currently still for a small faction of pirates in the regional government of North Rhine-Westphalia. But the period is ending soon, and I think we won't be voted back into office. But I'm still out and about doing my job otherwise for the same cause. So first, just so that you know, this presentation is very much a European bias, because I decided to just say what to stick to what I know about, what I've studied and everything else. And if there's anything relevant that you might think about that you know that is not applicable for Europe, but for any place in the rest of the world, please tell me so, because I know it's just European based, this. And maybe if anyone feels religious, there's one small joke about a Christian figure, but it's not very, very bad, but I still want to be so fair and warn you. And the next thing is that the points are, of course, open points and not anything really elaborate, so it's just sort of to start get people talking about the concept of credibility. We all know there's this unicorn craze going on, and I think I first noticed it with this chocolate you see from Rittersport, this very famous German chocolate brand that sort of inspired by the internet said, yeah, we're going to have unicorn chocolate. And I thought, wow, that sounds something that maybe an English or an American chocolate company would do, but not a German one. Germans are always about, yeah, I don't know, it won't sell, and people won't take it seriously, and then we'll produce it, and only three people will buy it, and then suddenly Rittersport goes making unicorn chocolate. I think there's something changing. And that was one of the moments that gave me the idea for this talk. So now even you can buy unicorn things to clean your body with, and even the unicorn dies and the dinosaurs eat it, and you could even use unicorn toilet paper to make your ass even sweeter. And then, of course, there's a question also in the media, why are unicorns so popular? Well, have you read the news? Sometimes it feels like reading a dystopian novel, or maybe like The Hunger Games. And also 3 years ago at Republica, there was the talk about uniconomics and about more whimsy into also economics and anything that people do, just sort of let go, be more whimsical, and that will give you a lot more inspiration and maybe, yeah, make you feel better and work better together. So these kind of things that came from internet culture have sort of seeped into the mainstream, even into the mind of a chocolate manufacturer or people who make soap. Whimsy. Now, whimsy is something, as I said, that sort of helps people feel better, especially after 2016, after first losing a lot of celebrities and then having a massive orange move into the White House. And press is asking the question, this is here from Berliner Morgenpost in German, and they're asking the question, why are the unicorns popular? And two media scientists say one is more sort of a bit more imaginative and says, yeah, people need whimsy and sort of a bit of a fantasy land and happy ending. A unicorn can symbolize a happy ending to people, and it just makes them feel better in this world that seems, through all the media that we consume and read and on social media, is what she said beforehand. Yeah, it's like war of the bots or war of just all this opinionatedness. It just makes you feel better, have a kind of safe space and say, oh, I want to use my unicorn soap, and it makes me feel better. And if that makes you feel better, I think it's actually a pretty good thing. There's other people saying that it kind of turns us into children, and some people, of course, criticizing it. We've got freedom of speech, freedom of opinion. People can, of course, criticize it, but the arguments this author used, I think, are a bit weird. She goes on and says, yeah, People who used to live in times of depression or world wasn't as nice used to start drinking alcohol, take drugs, and now, yeah, kids aren't taking as many drugs, but they're drinking all those stupid unicorn frappuccinos now, thinking, girl, where are your priorities? Because on the one hand, you've got media saying people having to be more healthy and lose weight and there's fat shaming and everything. And on the other hand, you've got someone criticizing people for just having fun with unicorns and glitter instead of drinking and taking drugs. Let that sink in. So millennials are supposed to grow up and be like their parents because maybe our parents in the 70s didn't drink out of unicorn mugs, but it was just different times. And I think, why is this whimsy intolerance or this intolerance of people like my age? I'm going up to 40, but I haven't lost my youthfulness because growing up on the net, growing up in on social media and with nerdy people, age just seems to really turn into a number, except for maybe you feel it when your back starts hurting and you're not as fit as in your 20s. On the other hand, in your mind, you just stay that way. I think when I look at some other people, I know they think the same way. So is it just plain adultism, or can you sort of culturally trace it to something else? And I say yes. Geez, exactly that. First, we can have a look at how millennials view getting old and becoming an adult. And of course, funnily enough, there's the unicorn symbol in there again. The thing, several variations of this picture, and you've got the unicorn, you've got the rainbow, you've got space, you've got whimsy again, and saying, yeah, okay, I might be doing adult things, I've got a job, I pay my bills, I've got an insurance and a car, but I still haven't lost my imagination. And this T-shirt just shows, yeah, it's just mimicking something. And I would say even our parents and grandparents' generation were actually just mimicking what other older people were doing just to fit into a norm. So maybe our generation with the internet are making dissent and different ways of behaving more acceptable and visible are just changing something that I would say is an old secularized norm from Christianity, from old monastic culture in the Middle Ages. What? Okay. First, let's say what's credible. What's credible, I would say, from a European point of view and maybe Anglo-American point of view. That is something earnest, familiar, there's a father, there's a mother, there are things you know you can rely upon, and those things just have certain characteristics, something that's acceptable. It fits into a certain social norm. It can be good or bad, that doesn't matter, that's neutral. But you see, this kind of credibility or ideas of credibility have always been questioned, like Oscar Wilde did with the importance of being earnest, playing on the words about it's actually important to be a man called earnest to win the heart of a woman and not just to be earnest. But go even further down, what is earnest and credible? And it goes back to him again, goes back to Jesus. Because who's read the Name of the Rose? Umberto Eco? Oh, you have. Oh, yeah, very nice. Oh, good. So, Name of the Rose is all about Jesus never smiling, and people not smiling and being happy and laughing are imitating Jesus. And by imitating Jesus, you're a good Christian. And the only reason a good Christian should ever smile or be happy or be merry is in the world of carnival, where the world is turned upside down for a couple of days. On the other hand, you just have to be very solemn and think of Jesus, or in Latin you call it imitatio Christi, to imitate Christ. So apparently Jesus didn't smile, so good Christians shouldn't smile. And that was carried over into sort of non-religious, secularized life, where even now the face of someone credible is mostly not really smiling or laughing, maybe a smile, Mona Lisa smile. And now this, just have a look at him. So laughter is dangerous, and people who laugh, of course, can criticize things, and laughter and happiness is something that gives an individual a bit more freedom and is not so controllable. And when you look at these historic pictures, and I've thought, okay, what is credibility in history? I started with Jesus. Do you know who the guy in the middle is? Anyone know that? That was Louis XIV, the Sun King, when he was 14 years old in a dance. And the lady there is, of course, Marie Antoinette. So it starts with Louis XIV. And in those times, in the 16th century, as a noble person, it was really important to dance. Dancing was just like being able to fight with a sword or being able to rule your people was important and a way to show that you fitted in into courtly life. And only even after, let's say, Louis XIV took over the rule and the Ballet du Corps also started involving women, were even women allowed to become ballet dancers. Beforehand, it was just only men ballet dancing. I'll come up to that a bit later. So this is a traditional ballet dancer of today, and I took a picture that was a bit maybe, let's say, cliche with a pink dress, a tutu, and ballet is now seen as maybe something that's girly or frivolous, but it used to be something that carried court credibility, and the ballet dancers that were shown in court, especially in the 16th century at Versailles or in the Louvre beforehand, or they also started to open ballet and theatre houses all over Paris. Those were also ways of state propaganda. They were sort of showing they're half improvised dancers, you can imagine, that were mixtures of mythology, of especially Greek and Roman mythology, and current events. And the event where, let's just go back, I want to show that again, this one, was after the civil wars, the Fronde took place, just before Louis XIV took over the reign as a young man, was he, after these civil wars, these in France stopped, that he staged this ballet, showed that the rising light, the rising sun is there now, and a new era is beginning. So that was something of highest credibility and not fluffiness. And this picture here is the ballerina shown there, Lauren Anderson, and that is sort of a kind of costume that you wore in the years of Louis XIV in the Baroque. I just thought that was a nice sort of thing to add. And now, of course, with ballet, you've also got Billy Elliot of sort of changing these gender norms again. That is, of course, perfectly acceptable for a young man to be a ballet dancer, like in the days of Louis XIV. So another thing with credibility was Marie Antoinette, who was showed earlier on already, was that when she arrived in court in the late 18th century, just after the middle of the 18th century, she was also 14 years old, and she had to gain credibility. She had to gain the acceptance of the court because she was an Austrian princess. She, of course, was the outsider, and she was married to the future King of France as the Dauphine then, and she had to, especially because she didn't have children until later, she had to gain her footing, and so she had pictures painted of herself in men's clothing hunting to show, yes, I am credible, I'm strong, I'm not just a girl in frilly dresses riding along with the hunting party, but I've got my pants on and I'm just as strong as Louis XIV. And you even look at the little details, the leopard print saddle. They both have that. And that's something, I tried to look that up. If anyone knows what symbol that is in the pictures, I would be happy if someone would tell me. So this is where everything took place, Versailles, just for the atmosphere. And this is the royal family later from Marie Antoinette. But then it ended. And also credibility of also with all the very pompous, very sort of, if you show a lot of gold, if you show a lot of big dresses, ample decorations was something of shown of state power, and that ended. And then I'm going to show you about the 19th century until the 20th century, how things changed. So especially in the 19th century later, there was emerging science, there was industry, there was progress, and things were starting to get better, even though politically it was going a bit there and back, and democracy was always challenged by aristocrats. And if you think of credibility and people having a say in things, may it be aristocrats or may it be people from bourgeois people, they wear suits, they're men, they are somber, they still carry this idea of Jesus not smiling and also are very serious and earnest. And this is, I want to show you the evolution of the man's suit since the end of the 18th century. You can see that the shape gradually changes and the trousers get longer. And the trousers get longer because first the culottes that used to be worn were from the French aristocracy, and after the revolution you shouldn't look like a French aristocrat or else you could maybe lose your head. So trousers became longer. Oh, actually, where is the other? Okay, they're gone. So now we're on to the 20th century. And in the, oh, that was mixed up because that was now the other things. Well, anyway, this is the 20th century and you can see there were the suffragettes, there was the victory, after World War II. And then there was the civil rights movement, there was the environmental movement. And you can see in the background, I've got the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end sort of from World War I. So that change things, and also you can see here men's fashion, still long trousers, a trouser suit, and it still started changing even less what a credible man, a person in public should look like. And until now, even you have got a woman wearing the same, and you think of someone wearing a suit as either a politician or a business person. And it's serious business. Very serious business. Internet is serious business. So then, with the advent of the internet, things started to change again. And things became either progressive or reactionary, trying to move the other way again. And both became very visible. And you can see in this picture, I would say this picture shows everything that changed. Things sort of meme culture came about, and meme culture either helped people become more visible that weren't visible beforehand, women, minorities, and so on. But also on the other hand, what the backlash looked like, because look at that unicorn, it's got a swastika, but it's also got rainbows, and it's got bombs, and it's got fire, and it's got everything, it's the internet. So why did this happen since the advent of the internet? And let's have another look at the 20th century. And you can say in the 20th century, things sort of, after 18th, 19th, there were also progressive changes, but they were very slow, I would say. In the 20th century, it became much faster. And I would in a very rough way say, you can see certain types of parts of life where you can say a news anchor is something that shows what credibility is, professional dress codes, politicians, and also representation of different types of people in movies, culture, on pop music stages, and so on. So let's start with the news. This lady depicted was the first female news anchor in Germany. And that was, of course, discussed very much amongst people then. I think it was the 70s, and it was like, what was that woman doing? She would have to take care of the children and not read the news. That's not a woman's job. There was women telling that to that woman that was wrong. And on the other hand, okay, what is a classic media outlet that you can trust from the 20th century? So you've got TV, you've got newspapers, you've got radio. And you've got especially the state-funded but the publicly funded stations, like I did, said to FBBC. And then you've got specialized media, which is seen as quite credible. on seriously something like Financial Times, Handelsblatt, it's about economy, or maybe even a sports magazine. And then less serious, but also seen as sort of a bit more weighty, is our expensive aspirational magazines like Vogue, Elle, Brigitte, sort of very more, yeah, okay, German woman, but not quite Hausfrau. Less serious, but still sort of in a certain esteem, is Playboy, and rather laughable but harmless, something like Playgirl, because that's people who are like men, gay men, and heterosexual women. And you can see here, I just tried to show that again. Yes, there's different types of seriousness or credibility in the 20th century that then later sort of got broken up. Rita Süssmuth, she was also a president of the Bundestag as a woman breaking barriers in the 20th century. And of course also the Green Party brought alternative lifestyles and dress into politics. That's the famous picture of Joschka Fischer becoming the minister of, Umweltminister, environmental minister, exactly. He was sworn in, and it was a big thing that he was wearing trainers and not dress shoes. And in culture in the 20th century, also things changed. It was more diverse representation, different age groups. You can see here the Golden Girls, there's Michael Jackson, there's Madonna, there was Lieutenant Uhura on Star Trek. And Star Trek was especially also very pioneering because it first showed a black woman and a white man kissing. And later on in Deep Space Nine in the 90s, they showed the first homosexual kiss on Star Trek. And what Star Trek did very well is just for representation, is here Whoopi Goldberg saying, because she saw Uhura on the classic Star Trek series. She's actually told Gene Roddenberry, I would like to have a part of that series and play in the new series Next Generation, where she became Guinan. And next thing about representation and things changing, and other hand, you've got reactionary thoughts, is this thing that happened on Twitter. The original tweet isn't there anymore, but there was one woman saying, my son, he was writing an essay in school about fairy tales, and he was supposed to write his fairy tale, and he wrote a fairy tale about a princess that was fighting. And the teacher then told the boy in the correcting and said, that's wrong, that's not like a classic fairy tale has to be, because princesses don't fight. The internet said this. Princesses do fight. And then there's more representation from Star Trek. There's Captain Sisko and good old Captain Janeway, and they will be back soon again, so I will go on. And then into the 21st century. And I would say the era started to change with 9/11. You can see in the background. And then even more things happened, and things just got less linear and less, I say, overseeable, as maybe we will when we look back to the 20th century. And still, on the other hand, things are starting to get better, and diversity became better, and also the way credibility was seen. So you've got internet culture, you've got open debates about what is disrespectful behavior, what is just relaxing old social norms about how people should treat themselves in public or at work. And you've got reactionary people and progressive people clashing even harder, especially on social media. And since change has become more visual, and this visible change has given people who have white people, male white people, also female white people, a feeling, especially in the States, of suddenly something being taken away from them, something they can't feel free anymore because they can't behave like dickheads they used to be. And so they had the feeling that all these minorities or women and people from different countries with different skin colors were taking things away from them. And they were starting to voice this online, which ended with Trump getting voted into the White House. But let's go back to the progressive things that happened. German Chancellor, a woman with rainbow suits. and unicorns in front of the Reichstag. Awesome. And here you see her pantsuits, and now this is something that will be important later, because what does a powerful woman look like? What does a shift look like from the traditional male suit in mostly dark colors with a tie and the roughly same type of cut that have been around since at least 100 years or 150 years? You've got the same thing with Hillary Clinton, by the way. Very similar pantsuits. And I think Angela Merkel and Hillary Clinton could swap wardrobes, no one would notice. And then you've got also the change with the Obamas moving into the White House in 2008, which was, of course, also a shift in visibility. And I would say one of just one reason in pop culture, because of representation, is people got used to seeing a black man in charge of something really big, like Benjamin Sisko of Deep Space Nine, that this seeing something represented in media, in storytelling, makes things possible in people's heads. It makes it more plausible. So someone like, one small factor that must have played into Obama being sort of looking like a presidential person, a person that can be in charge of the United States, is also the representation beforehand in science fiction, especially utopian story like Star Trek. And then you've also got the first female Minister of Defense, and now I don't know if I really pronounce her name properly, Carme Chacon. She was from Catalonia. She passed away due to a heart failure, but she was the first Minister of Defense and started her job as a pregnant woman. And that's something very special, because usually you think of being a defense minister, being in charge of an army, as a very male job, and thinking of killing people and going to war. And then you've got this woman in the European Union, a peace union, who still, of course, is in charge of an army, and she's carrying a baby in her body. And that was, I think, quite a powerful image. On the other hand, when you think of representation, Captain Janeway, you've got Samantha Cristoforetti, who was on the ISS, and when she was on her way there, she was actually cosplaying as Captain Catherine Janeway, and the internet exploded. She broke the internet. Exactly. And another thing with progressive thinking and breaking boundaries of thinking, well, we've got even lots of automation, and robots doing things, and bots doing things, and computer taking over the work of people, and of course, us talking about a basic income and questioning the work or ethos of the traditional Protestants has become even louder, because Protestant work ethic is all about, if you don't work, if you don't make money, if you can't tend to yourself, you are worthless. And this type of thinking is still very eminent and very visible in the newly passed healthcare bill the United States have just trying to pass. Is if you are sick, you're weak, and you're not worth to live, and that's bullshit. Another thing with visibility with Black Lives Matter is this nurse from New York who was became a very an icon of the Black Lives Matter movement, with just standing there resisting these police people, just showing, yes, this nurse, this mother is visible and showing resistance against this white male establishment, just very placative. On the reactionary side, we've got also people from the internet wanting to have their old male world back, which actually didn't exist anymore. And when you look at what Trump stands for, it's very traditional, because it actually looks, when you look at Trump, you try and see him emulating Versailles. You try and look at what his apartment looks like. It's like sort of a very weird Versailles copy remix in New York, and then you've got the original on the other side. And you've all, what's very interesting at the same thing is, everyone standing up, except for the patriarch, the king, or here, Donald Trump, are sitting on a comfortable but very elaborately golden decorated chair. And even though things have changed, and women, minorities, and other people are allowed to become credible, allowed to be in public, and allowed to hold office, and even the highest offices, the standards are still very different. And I think we've been talking about that a lot on social media, that Donald Trump just had very little things that he shouldn't do. And for Hillary Clinton, let's say, oh, her tone of voice has to be this way or that way, or else she's too shrill or she's too quiet or whatever. On the other hand, something that's interesting is what I would say a diversity paradox in what I call the backlash bubble, the bubble of people that want to go back again, change things, old family values, ethnic pride, and so on. And the woman here shown is Alice Weidel, and she's a lesbian. She's part of the AfD, the German new right-wing party, that actually is not very pro LGBT people, not very queer friendly, and also not very friendly towards people who are not, who do not live in traditional families. And then on the other hand, from America, yes? Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then there's here this other guy, Milo, who's gay and still was on the Trump camp, and he's very, well, I think, who knows who Milo is? For people who don't know, he's this sort of their media figure, pundit. He was a Breitbart, contributor, who very hateful person, and not actually someone you would think who is maybe gay, urban, and progressive, but the other way around. And I would say this diversity backlash comes from maybe people not wanting that type of representation, but reality still has it. These kinds of people are in public now, and even they go, and their opinions might not be the same as other people. And even though you might be gay, you may be black, you might be Turkish, you might be German, and so on, that's not everything about you, and you might still be able to have different opinions, so you can join right-wing groups, but you can still become visible there, even though those groups apparently don't like those people. The cute, yes, here, if they don't like it or not, those people exist and they still rise up and become visible. And sort of as a, this, do you see something happening in here, in that picture? Exactly, because that's the real picture. And that is with this healthcare plan. I would say that was sort of thought of the reactionary counterpoint to the discussion about basic income is, even this Protestant work ethic and saying people who become sick, people who don't have enough money to pay for healthcare, aren't worth to be saved or become healthy again or have doctors tending to them. So they say, no, of course, we can take it away from them. And they feel very righteous and very good because there are certain even Christian traditions telling them it is that way. And this is the tweets where I got it from. It was just so funny. I wanted to share that with you. And it's also been fixed. And then 2016 came about. And did you know that 2016 was called the year of global understanding? Somehow very ironic. And 2016 effect, I would say there's on one hand, even a consolidation of diversity and also the consolidation of what I call the backlash bubble of people not wanting that diversity and wanting to go back in time again. And people who before 2016 were in that backlash bubble were sort of in an underground. And this is a German example, Eva Herrmann, who used to be a normal newsreader, who was credible. She was a news anchor woman on public television. And then through very weird, sexist, and also Nazi apologizing comments on German television in a talk show, she was very quickly ostracized to be not credible anymore. And so she started reading the news for Kopfnachrichten. Kopf is something you could say, I don't know if it completely compare it to Breitbart, but a similar swing, maybe with a bit more tinfoil hat, is Kopf. And this is just for German media, but it also shows how diverse, these are lots of traditional mediums, but also online mediums in there, where you can see which medium is maybe not so trustworthy, or maybe just a little bit biased, and that when you read those different types of media, you just know who is writing it, what point of view is behind it, and what does the medium want to tell me apart from maybe giving me news. And this is something that's becoming more and more important, because it's not like in the 20th century where you had a couple of newspapers that were maybe a bit more right-wing or more left-wing, and maybe just the state television before RTL, one of the first private stations, came to Germany. And it's just becoming very diverse, and you just have to really open your eyes and think and consult people, talk about it, and see what is good. And now 2016, I called it Vogue One, because Teen Vogue used to be a magazine and also an online medium for teenage girls interested in fashion, lifestyle, and beauty. And then Trump got elected, and they started becoming a political commentary medium. And a lot of it, this was, I would say, the first breakthrough article that was just went viral. Everyone went crazy and said, God, Teen Vogue is saying what the Washington Post or the New York Times should be saying about Trump after his inauguration. And then you can see who is newsworthy and who reports it. And the scope of that was opening up, because, as I showed you, for the 20th century, magazines like Vogue or maybe Teen Vogue were sort of, yeah, whimsical fashion, maybe to take serious as in the cultural lifestyle aspects, but not for politics. You don't expect a magazine geared towards women to be as political as maybe something geared towards men. This is changing very, very fast. And so everything's becoming more diverse, and then you can say the backlash bubble is saying, oh God, everything's just pandering to everyone, and what about us, and all lives matter, white lives matter, and so on. And then you can ask, who is actually free? And what does democratic media mean towards backlash bubble media? And you could say, these days, more democratic media, they support, they just have, democracy is important. They go and challenge people's views. They question things more, and they don't go confirming things. And also they show even more and more different types of representation. They have people on television shows being more represented than maybe beforehand. They have more women writing scripts. They're trying to get women or people of color directing films and so on, even though it's taking a long time. But when you compare the Oscars from 2016 and the Oscars of this year, there was the discussion about Oscars so white, and there was a reaction in Hollywood, and it was visible, and it was you could see that the Academy, Hollywood, and so on are trying to change. It takes a long time, but there's this democratic self-challenge that takes a long time, but it's taking place. Even though some of them still be moldy old white men, but they're not backlash bubble. And you can see backlash bubble media is just more about outrage, and you can see that they always try and stay in the same cycle of being who we are, born how we are, from this ethnicity, and trying to just stay like in a washing machine, just going round and round. And yes, the progressive is challenging, and reactionary is just more confirming. So They just go, yeah, we are who we are. We want to stay how we are and not change. On the other hand, you've got discussions going on between left and right. And the funny thing is the people who are being discussed as objects of this discussion are from the backlash bubble. And this is very interesting. You remember this? Kellyanne Conway on the sofa looking at a picture she was taking of the representatives of traditionally black colleges that were visiting President Trump just after his inauguration. And she was actually just doing her job as one of the spokespeople and publicists of the White House is taking pictures for social media, doing her job, maybe looking a bit more comfortable, but doing her bloody job. So she was actually just relaxing old social norms, but not really being disrespectful. And then you've got this old picture. That was from the 20th century, the Iron Lady, on a very similar looking sofa with her legs up, looking at important documents from her to-do chest. You can even see the royal seal on the one on the other side. It's quite nice. And the famous handbag and her shoes at the bottom. Disrespectful, or is she just doing her job and being relaxed? And then on the other hand, you've got the male stance, and that's not quite as comfortable as being on the sofa, is just Obama putting his feet up. And when you look at business fashion and sort of what are you supposed to wear at work, you can just see on this picture, business casual, which is more the dress down business clothing, for women is much more relaxed. And I know that many men complain that work at banks or have to adhere to very strict dress codes, hate summer when they don't have air conditioning, especially in Europe or other countries, not like America. And they have to wear long sleeves and so on. And you can see that that is also, you could say, sexist in several ways, because when you see this lady in business casual, she looks quite decorative. She looks pretty, where a man shouldn't look pretty because he has to be more credible. He has to be a decider. And the woman can maybe just be a decoration, even in business. And when you look at female authority beyond cake caregiving, it's just starting to grow, because mostly when you think of authoritative female people, you think of mothers, you think of nurses, you think of teachers, but you rarely think of bosses, except maybe they become more villains, like a witch. You think of even down to the powerful whore. And the powerful whore is something the Christians and the Catholic Church in the early Middle Ages really feared. This is a very big text, and if you want, you can take a picture of it. It's about something called pornocracy. Not pornography, but pornocracy is the rule of the harlot, that in the saeculum obscurum, the Dark Ages, was coined in the 19th century by Protestant theologians about this time in the early Middle Ages when women, wives, lovers of popes took influence on what happened on the Holy Chair, what the Pope did. These women had a say, even though they shouldn't. So you could say the when celibacy was introduced, was also introduced so that not that the men shouldn't have fun and have sex, but they just shouldn't have wives and lovers that could maybe interfere in the men's club of the Catholic Church. But what does female power really look like? And this picture is maybe a bit of contrast with Theresa May, Miss Brexit, and Miss Leader of the Free World, Angela Merkel. And I went back to her pantsuits. And there's also Hillary's pantsuits again, but that's not all. There's also Christine Lagarde, who doesn't look like that colourful pantsuit clone, but she wears scarves, she has different accessories. There's also Nicola Sturgeon from Scotland, and she often wears a skirt. I think that what she's wearing there with the shoulder detail looks quite interesting. It just also gives it a bit more feeling of flair and freedom and say, no, we want to break out of the norm of the pantsuit, look elegant, credible, but change, get out of the mold. There's Condoleezza Rice looking maybe a bit more traditional with the pearl necklace. Very, you know who this is? Ruth Bader Ginsburg for the Supreme Court. There's Ellen Powell, who used to be the CEO of Reddit and was hated out. So she's a businesswoman who has a lot of hate geared towards her because she's in the tech world, engaged in the tech world, in this man's club world. And to just put it short, she has been through a lot of shit. And the next woman, Cindy Gallup, she's more from the advertising marketing world. And she's very remarkable because she doesn't look like anything those other women look like. She wants to change the world and sort of make sex socially more acceptable so that we can end sexual violence. I would look her up, Cindy Gallup. She's awesome. And then what female power actually really looks like to me, definite sort of female power, is when you look up on Google, leader of the free world, you see her, Angela Merkel. And she, the German chancellor, was named the leader of the free world because usually the American president would be called that, but then Donald Trump came to power and that term didn't fit anymore. And the only person that was sort of stood out to be that was actually the German chancellor. And when you see how history in German acted toward, throughout history, in the especially in the early 20th century, and afterwards had this Vergangenheitsbewältigung. So teaching children what was bad, what did Germany do wrong, what were the sort of the sins the Germans committed, and how can you stop doing that and never let it happen again? That is a process of actually becoming adult as a nation. Adult not in the sense of being boring, but actually becoming a riper personality as a nation. Germany is actually, I think maybe the only country worldwide that's actually gone through that because of the atrocities committed by the Nazis. And then later, after World War II in the 50s, 60s and so on, cleansed themselves of this and are still very, very aware of what happened. And even here in Berlin, in the capital, have lots of monuments commemorating the crimes the Germans committed. And that's something that other nations still, in depth the way the Germans have done, yet have to still do. And now we go, what about the free time and credibility? We've got movies, we've got different representation in people in movies, and you've got, of course, movie accolades, prizes. And then when I talked about women's fashion changing, and then you've got men going to galas, still wearing suits, but they're still trying to sort of break out of this prison and still look credible and manly and good, but still saying, hey, I'm at a gala and all the women are wearing glittery, cool dresses and being asked what designer dresses them and I just have to wear a suit and I also want to be fabulous. So they're trying to sort of break the mold, and you have the Met Gala that takes place in New York, where you can see men are becoming more whimsical or sort of breaking the norms. Can you? They're looking like someone who's just going to the supermarket to get bread. Still, better than always just wearing a suit. And then also female visibility of being taken serious as someone doing something as a subject and not just an object. Because, yeah, women are visible of being fashion dolls or maybe just representing glamour and being pretty. But when you look at who maybe gets best picture, who's the best director in the Oscars, you've got mostly men wearing suits. And next thing in the free time is, look at hobbies. Which hobbies are seen as sort of more manly, more credible, more normal, and which are the things that... Okay, I'm nearly finished. And then you've got this, case modding. Case modding, yeah, whimsy with my computer, but it's something deemed more masculine, so it's sort of cool. And when you use makeup, case modding your body, oh, it's girly, it's gay. But also if you're a manly man and you want to maybe take pictures of yourself, you maybe just want to look fresh on a stage, why shouldn't you use makeup? You can look pretty decent no matter what gender you've got wearing makeup. And people are starting to realize this in the second decade of the 21st century. You've got people men starting to knit arts and crafts. You've got more men with makeup, and you've got women gaming, and you've got unicorn makeup, and men wearing glittery makeup. And then with men wearing makeup, I want to finish with RuPaul, who, this is something got to do with Europe and America, is for a long time, when you have Europeans thinking about America, you think of this strong patriotism like that. America, yeah, guns and violence and, yeah, this very stereotypical manliness. And then RuPaul, after Trump was elected, was saying things on his podcast that got me thinking about me seeing American patriotism as something that I can take seriously and credible, because for a lot of people in the States, it's not just about guns and violence and all this America thing, but it's actually really still about the country where everyone can go to, the melting pot that becomes so strong and so progressive because of all the different types of people that moved there, made a living there, and maybe even lived the American dream. And I thought, okay, that is something that to be proud of, even as not if you're a white nationalist. And then you've got Europe. And then you've got what happened, except for in Britain, Europe standing together, Europe and diversity. And I was thinking, especially when Pulse of Europe came about, is you can't really call it patriotism, but actually call it European enthusiasm, and say it's this mixture between saying, yeah, thank goodness, we've got the European Union and we can make more out of it than just a political or economic union where people in suits decide boring things, but actually something that is still keeping peace in Europe and we're not killing each other like in the last two world wars. And we can be proud of it and see it as a seed of global citizenship, actually really being citizens of planet Earth, and maybe even if maybe sentient beings from space see us and think, oh God, they're starting to get better, these human beings. Maybe we'll make first contact with them. And that's why on Europe Day, happy Europe Day, and may they make things nicer. Thank you very much. So, any questions? Or are you tired? Okay, no questions, so we go have a party and drink.